もし私に彼氏ができた冬休みは恋人の定番のデートコースを歩きたい。私に彼氏ができないわけは
今日は Now, though the enchanter gnash his teeth vainly, yet shall he return as the spring returns. O wretched man! Hell gapes, Erebus now lies open. The mouths of death wait on thy end.
Hear now the words. Greetings! I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
It is my privilege to place a nomination for the office of President of the United States, the one man whom history has so clearly thrust forward, the one whom all America will recognize as a man.
Over the summer, the Republicans at a Unity and Harmony convention in Miami Beach pick a familiar figure as their candidate for president.
The Honorable Richard M. Nixon.
In sharp contrast, Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey wins the Democratic nomination at a fierce convention in Chicago that leaves his party torn and bleeding. And George Corley Wallace of Alabama declares as the law and order candidate of a third party. Radio Moscow suddenly triggers the worrisome guessing game anew by announcing that the Soviet spacecraft Zond 5 has splashed down in the Indian Ocean on September 21st, after an unmanned flight in which it whipped around the moon, though without entering moon orbit. At Cape Kennedy, Wally Schirra, the nerveless veteran of superb Mercury and Gemini flights, Mr. Cool himself, suddenly finds himself at age 45 feeling a little old and tired. The 18-hour-a-day grind, the separation from his family, have taken out all the fun. Yes, he's having a ball. What lifted Wally's spirit so dramatically is the brilliant launch on October 11th of Apollo 7 atop the well-proven Saturn 1B. It's our first manned flight since Gus Grissom and his crew were killed in the fire on the same launch pad 21 months ago. Another serious failure would have all but erased hope of landing an American on the moon by the end of 1970.
About 24 hours after liftoff, we'll commence a sequence of exercises aimed at doing a rendezvous with the S-4B booster that we're separated from about 3 hours after liftoff.
In the middle seat, to the right of Wally, and serving as navigator on his first flight, Air Force Major Don Eisley, who won his place in the spacecraft by applying over and over for astronaut training until he got an answer of yes.
One of the prime requisites of this flight is to come back with a feeling that all of the spacecraft systems are capable of supporting a flight of duration that would take you to the
moon.
That's
Walt Cunningham, former Marine pilot and also a first-timer. On this flight, his job is to test out every system in the brand-new Apollo spacecraft.
We've been monitoring Schirra's heart rate because that's the only physical parameter we have coming through, and it's at launch and through the early stages ran about 90 to 92 beats.
Can you imagine that?
4 minutes, 50 seconds into the flight.
He's such a cool son of a gun.
15 hours into the flight, Wally Schirra, hero of so many space achievements, becomes the first man in space to develop a cold.
I have a nose cold. I've probably gone through about 8 or 9 Kleenex with some pretty good flows. I've taken 2 aspirin, and I'm wondering if there's anything else I can take.
Dr. Chuck Berry prescribes decongestant pills for Wally, and also his 2 shipmates, who have soon come to share his cold. Next, Wally's first public flash of temper. For weeks before the flight, he resisted a pet NASA plan for a live telecast airborne from the spacecraft. Now, when asked to prepare for the telecast, Schirra replies,
"You've added a urine water dump, and we have a new vehicle up here, and I'm saying at this point TV will be delayed without any further discussion until after the rendezvous."
2 days later, with most of their work accomplished, the crew puts on a Wally, Walt, and Don TV show in which they flash before the camera previously prepared cue cards, like, "From the lovely Apollo room, high atop everything," and,
"Okay, what's the next one? A little closer, Wally. Just keep those cards and letters coming in, folks. It's loud and clear."
The first light moments on the world scene in the year 1968. On the fifth day, Schirra evens an old score with Slayton. In 1962, during Wally's Mercury flight, Deke put Wally on the spot by publicly facing him with a turtle routine, to which Schirra manfully gave the required answer. Now the tables are turned.
"Just a minute, Wally, let's see. Oh, it's a little message to Deke Slayton."
"That's right."
"Looks like it says, are you a turtle, Deke Slayton?"
"That's right."
Slayton replies, but on a closed circuit. As the days grind on, there are further sparks of irritation from space. NASA doctors blame the head colds, long confinement, and monotony of an almost perfect flight. Paul Haney, noting that the crew has gone unshaven, offers another theory.
"Something happens to a guy who grows a beard. The next thing, he starts to protest."
"Good point."
Finally, after 163 turns about the Earth and almost 11 days in space, Apollo 7 splashes down in the Atlantic, 230 miles south of Bermuda. From Lieutenant General Sam Phillips, Apollo Program Director, comes the appraisal.
"Apollo 7 goes in my book as a perfect mission. In my experience, this is the first space operation that's accomplished more than 100% of its pre-planned objectives. Our official count is that we accomplished 101% of our intended objectives. I'd conclude by saying that the Apollo program is now in the manned flight phase, which many of us have been working some years to accomplish, that we can see the lunar landing, and I have every confidence myself that the progress of our missions will let us accomplish that by the end of next year."
In 260 hours and 8 minutes aloft, the crew of Apollo 7 compiled more man-hours in space than all the manned Russian flights combined. Most of all, they've proved that Apollo's structure, control, navigation, communications, and life support systems are completely spaceworthy. October 26th, 4 days after the homecoming of Apollo 7, the Soviets make another baffling launch of their own from their Baikonur Cosmodrome on the south-central plains of Asian Russia. Colonel Georgi T. Beregovoy goes up in spacecraft Soyuz 3 to perform rendezvous maneuvers with a previously orbiting and unmanned Soyuz 2. Twice, the two ships are guided toward each other, automatically and manually, but reportedly no closer than 650 feet, with no attempt at docking. A Soviet commentator declares that the eventual aim is to link in space several craft that would form an orbiting laboratory. So again, American spacemen ask, what are the Russians really up to? In the next 10 days, a presidential campaign that has been saturated with surprises produces yet two more. On Thursday, October 31st, after months of stalemated peace talks in Paris between representatives of the U.S. and North Vietnam, President Johnson, in a 20-minute TV talk, announces,
"I have now ordered that all air, naval, and artillery bombardment of North Vietnam cease as of 8 a.m. Washington time Friday morning. I have reached this decision on the basis of the developments in the Paris talks, and I have reached it in the belief that this action can lead to progress toward a peaceful settlement of the Vietnamese War."
Some Republicans denounced the move as a political trick to bolster the long, sagging campaign of Hubert Humphrey. True or not, the election winds up as an all-night horse race. Not until well into the next morning can the winner be determined with absolute certainty. Richard Nixon, by a nose and an eyelash, in one of the most remarkable political comebacks in U.S. history. Then, early in the morning of the day before Christmas, 1968, from 230,000 miles out in space, comes a radio message that only days before was still considered impossible by most people on Earth. The voice of Captain Jim Lovell, who on two Gemini flights logged 7 million miles and became the most traveled man in history. Speaking now for the three-man crew of Apollo 8.
Our orbit is 169.1 by 60.5.
With those plain words, he informs the world that Apollo 8 has accomplished the mind-shaking feat of entering the orbit of the moon, and is flying an elliptical course that swoops as low as 60.5 miles from that dead and awesome surface. Later, in a telecast to all the world, the crew give us the reactions of Earthmen taking the first close-up look at the moon in the 4 or 5 billion years since it was created. First, the spacecraft commander, Frank Borman.
The moon is a different thing to each one of us. I think that each one carries his own impressions of what he's seen today. I know my own impression is that it's a vast, lonely, forbidding type existence or expanse of nothing. It looks rather like clouds and clouds of pumice stone, and it certainly would not appear to be a very inviting place to live or work. Jim, what have you thought most about?
Well, Frank, my thoughts were very similar. The vast loneliness up here on the moon is awe-inspiring, and it makes you realize just what you have back there on Earth. The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
Bill, what do you think?
Bill is Air Force Major William Anders, third man in the spacecraft, an expert on radiation, whose special assignment is to study possible harm from expected solar flares.
I think the thing that impressed me the most were the lunar sunrises and sunsets. These in particular bring out the stark nature of the terrain, and the long shadows really bring out the relief that is here and hard to see in this very bright surface that we're going over right now.
Frank Borman, a lay reader of the Episcopal Church, says a prayer which he addresses to people everywhere.
Give us, O God, the vision which can see thy love in the world in spite of human failure. Give us the faith to trust the goodness in spite of our ignorance and weakness. Give us the knowledge that we may continue to pray with understanding hearts. And show us what each one of us can do to set forward the coming of the day of universal peace. Amen.
Amen.
I was supposed to lay read tonight, and I couldn't quite make it.
Right, I think they understand.
Apollo 8 was undertaken against 100 warnings of danger. At every press conference, someone asked if the astronauts would carry suicide pills. The answer each time was a flat no. The Apollo 8 crew simply did not consider this a suicide mission. As Frank Borman put it,
when you look at the overall mission, you come away with a realization that as any of these missions go, any of the lunar missions go, it's a conservative mission. Now, I don't believe in the trite saying that, you're accepting more risk by driving on a freeway or something like that. As far as I'm concerned, that's nonsense. Yeah. But the business is risky, and I think we've accepted a minimal amount of unknowns on this flight. I look at it as something like a combat tour in Vietnam.
Final reports coming from Frank Borman at this time. Final look at the switch list aboard the spacecraft. 35 seconds and counting.
Now, finally, on December 21st, at Launch Pad 39A, the three-man crew took their places atop a Saturn V rocket.
We just passed the 25-second mark in the count.
A newspaper report noted that Borman, Lovell, and Anders, though they have fathered 11 children among them, were themselves each an only child. And, continued the report, psychologists have found that only children are usually better achievers, better able to face challenges and climb the ladder of success.
4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have liftoff. Liftoff at 7:51.
Liftoff, the clock is running.
Roger, clock.
Roll and pitch program.
Roger.
How do you hear, Houston?
Loud and clear.
On the second Earth orbit, a five-minute burn of the third stage engine whips up speed from 17,400 miles an hour to a new record 24,200.
Ignition. Roger, ignition.
Roger.
Fast enough to hurl the spacecraft out of the Earth's gravitational clutch and inject it into a translunar path toward the moon.
Title flight. Go, flight. You look okay? We look go. Okay. Look good, Capcom.
Apollo 8 is cutting across space to catch the moon. Not at the point where it now is, but where it will reach 3 days hence, leading the moon as a hunter aims ahead of a flying duck.
We see the Earth now.
After Apollo 8 has passed the previous distance record of 853 miles set by Gemini 11, the craft is turned so that the astronauts can see the Earth they have left. Jim Lovell reports.
Beautiful view of Florida now. We can see the Cape just the point.
Roger.
And at the same time, we can see Africa. West Africa is beautiful. I can also see Gibraltar at the same time I'm looking at Florida.
Sounds good. Get a picture of it. What window are you looking out of?
The center window. I can see the entire Earth now out of the center window. I can see Florida, Cuba, Central America, the whole northern half of Central America, in fact, all the way down through Argentina, and down through Chile.
Hey, you picked a good day for it.
About a quarter of the way along the translunar path, the astronauts make a slight mid-course correction by firing the service module engine for a couple of seconds. A tweaking burn, as the engineers call it.
Apollo 8, this is Houston, all right?
Go ahead, Houston, I agree.
Yeah, Roger, we're reading you loud and clear. We're on a private loop now, and we'd like to get some amplifying details on your medical problem.
Could Next day, December 22nd, for all the medical precautions that were taken in advance of the flight, Frank Borman comes down with violent symptoms. Vomiting, diarrhea, chills, and headache. Lovell and Anders are hit with only a slight case of the same. Dr. Chuck Berry of NASA gets on the radio for the most distant medical diagnosis and treatment ever made at 120,000 miles. He decides it's 24-hour flu for Borman, milder versions for the others.
Frank, this is Chuck. Did you read that you ought to take the Lomotil and the Mirazine can be used if you do get nauseated, any one of the three of you?
Okay, thank you.
The first telecast has been scheduled for this day. Shots of the Earth and the astronauts at work. Despite illness, the show goes on, directed by Frank Borman.
Okay, we're rolling around to a good view of the Earth. And as soon as we get to the good view of the Earth, we'll stop and let you look out the window at the scene we see.
And with this, as if looking at its own face in a mirror, the Earth glimpses a glowing ball in space that is like a brighter moon, and almost like a sun. Next day, Monday, December 23rd, looking back at the Earth from over 175,000 miles, Jim Lovell speculates.
So, as seen from 180,000 miles,
out in space.
Michael, I keep imagining is if I'm some lonely traveler from another planet, what I think about the Earth from this altitude, whether I think it'd be inhabited or not.
Don't see anybody waving, is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm just kind of curious whether I would land on the blue or the brown part of the Earth.
To which Frank replies,
you better hope we land in the blue part.
So are we, babe.
Jim is always for land landing, sir.
An hour later, they reach a magical point, 200,000 miles out from Earth, where the moon's gravity exceeds the Earth's. In this moment, they become the first men in all time who are literally out of this world. Hour by hour, minute by minute, the pre-scheduled time approaches for lunar orbit insertion. Now, on December 24th, in the dark before the Texas dawn, 68 hours and 4 minutes from the time of launch at Cape Kennedy, a message goes from Jerry Carr, an astronaut trainee serving as captain.
Apollo 8, this is Houston at 6804, your go for LOI.
Frank Borman replies.
Okay, Apollo 8 is go.
You're riding the best bird we can find, over.
Thank you.
Now, 3,125 miles from the moon, Apollo 8 goes into a gentle curve toward the backside of the moon, pulled faster and faster now by the force of lunar gravity. 54 minutes later, it goes behind the moon. There, its radio communication with Earth will be blocked for 45 minutes by loss of signal. Just before the tense silence is to start, the official commentator in Houston, John McLeish, remarks,
2 minutes, 50 seconds away from time of LOS now. Our distance away from the moon, 460 nautical miles. Velocity, 7417 feet per second. Here in Mission Control, we're standing by. There's certainly a great deal of anxiety at this moment.
A last message for the moment from Jerry Carr.
Apollo 8 Houston, 1 minute to LOS, all systems go. Roger, safe journey, guys.
Bill Anders.
Thanks a lot, Trips. We'll see you on the other side.
Apollo 8, 10 seconds to go. You're go all the way.
Roger.
For the next 45 minutes, complete blackout. No one on Earth can know if the engine is fired on schedule or burned long enough to put the craft in orbit. Too short a burn could crash Apollo 8 into the moon. The longest 45 minutes in the universe. Then finally, from Houston.
Apollo Control, Houston. We're looking at engine data and it looks good. Tank pressures look good. We have not talked yet with the crew, but we're standing by. We've got it, we've got it. Apollo 8 now in lunar orbit. There's a cheer in this room. This is Apollo Control Houston, switching now to the voice of Jim Lovell.
By 60.5, good to hear your voice.
Jim Lovell, followed by wild cheering in Houston Control, in a Christmas Eve unlike any since the child's birth in a manger 1,968 years ago. For in this moment, returning from their first circle of the moon, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders have joined the ranks of the great explorers of history.
The moon is essentially gray. No color.
Again, they fire the engine to change their course to a smooth, even, circular orbit 70 miles above the moon. In all, they circle it 10 times over a period of some 21 hours, beaming back pictures of what they describe as a vast, forbidding expanse of nothing. They name craters for the 8 fellow astronauts who have died. On the 9th orbit, as they finish their third telecast, Bill Anders solemnly announces,
we are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth,
the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you.
With that, the three men begin reading the opening verses of the book of Genesis, starting with Bill Anders.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the gathering together of the
waters... telecast closes with Frank Borman signing off.
And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
An hour into Christmas Day, the SPS engine is scheduled to be fired and thrust Apollo 8 out of lunar orbit and back toward Earth. This is to take place on the dark side of the moon, where radio signals are blacked out. The world waits 37 minutes. That message from Jim Lovell as the spacecraft heads back toward Earth. Under the three main parachutes, Apollo 8 floats down into the Pacific south of Hawaii, 6 days and 3 hours from the moment of launch. With Apollo 8, a dark year ends in radiance. We learn that our troubled planet, observed from a distance, gives out a lovely Earthshine. Poet Archibald MacLeish sees mankind as riders on the earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold. The intelligent adventurousness of the moonshot, the calm daring of the crew, the perfection of the equipment, the dazzling precision of the entire operation, all this suddenly reawakens mankind to an appreciation of its best possibilities.
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/Publius_reads. Thank you.
7.